and became comfortably buzzed by martinis on the planes. They talked and giggled together. Mrs. Wheatley said funny things about the stewardesses and their beautifully pressed jackets and bright artificial makeup, or talked about how silly some of her neighbors in Lexington were. She was high-spirited and confidential and amusing, and Beth would laugh a long time and look out the window at the clouds below them and feel better than she had ever felt, even during those times at Methuen when she had saved up her green pills and taken 5 or 6 at once. She grew to love hotels and restaurants and the excitement of being in a tournament and winning it, moving up gradually game by game and having the crowd around her table increase with each win. People at tournaments knew who she was now. She was always the youngest there and sometimes the only female. Back at school afterward, things seemed more and more drab. Some of the other students talked about going to college after high school, and some had professions in mind. 2 girls she knew wanted to be nurses. Beth never participated in these conversations. She already was what she wanted to be. But she talked to no one about her traveling or about the reputation she was building in tournament chess. When they came back from Miami in March, there was an envelope from the Chess Federation in the mail. It was a new membership card with her rating, 1881. She had been told it would take time for the rating to reflect her real strength. She was satisfied for now to be finally a rated player. She would push the figure up soon enough. The next big step was Master at 2200. After 2000, they called you an expert, but that didn't mean much. The one she liked was International Grand Master. That had weight to it. That summer, they went to New York to play at the Henry Hudson Hotel. They had developed a taste for fine food, though at home it was mostly TV dinners. And in New York, they ate at French restaurants, taking buses cross town to Le Bistro and Café Argentile. Mrs. Wheatley had gone to a gas station in Lexington and bought a mobile travel guide. She picked places with 3 or more stars, and then they found them with the little map. It was terribly expensive, but neither of them said a word about the cost. Beth would eat smoked trout, but never fresh fish. She remembered the fish she'd had to eat on Fridays at Methuen. She decided that next year at school, she would take French. The only problem was that on the road, she took the pills from Mrs. Wheatley's prescription to help her sleep at night, and sometimes it required an hour or so to get her head clear in the morning. But tournament games never started before 9, and she made a point of getting up in time to have several cups of coffee from room service. Mrs. Wheatley did not know about the pills and showed no concern over Beth's appetite for coffee. She treated her in every way, like an adult. Sometimes it seemed as though Beth were the older of the two. Beth loved New York. She liked riding on the bus, and she liked taking the IRT subway with its grit and rattle. She liked window shopping when she had a chance, and she enjoyed hearing people on the street talking Yiddish or Spanish. She did not mind the sense of danger in the city, or the arrogant way the taxis drove, or the dirty glitter of Times Square. They went to Radio City Music Hall on their last night and saw West Side Story and the Rockettes. Sitting high in the cavernous theater in a velvet seat, Beth was thrilled. She had expected a reporter from Life to be someone who chain-smoked and looked like Lloyd Nolan, but the person who came to the door of the house was a small woman with steel-gray hair and a dark dress. The man with her was carrying a camera. She introduced herself as Jean Balky. She looked older than Mrs. Wheatley, and she walked around the living room with quick little movements, hastily checking out the books in the bookcase and studying some of the prints on the walls. Then she began asking questions. Her manner was pleasant and direct. "I've really been impressed," she said, "even though I don't play chess myself." she smiled. They say you're the real thing. Beth was a little embarrassed. How does it feel, being a girl among all those men? I don't mind it. Isn't it frightening? They were sitting facing each other. Miss Balky leaned forward, looking intently at Beth. Beth shook her head. The photographer came over to the sofa and began taking readings with a meter. When I was a girl, the reporter said, I was never allowed to be competitive. I used to play with dolls. The photographer backed off and began to study Beth through his camera. She remembered the doll Mr. Gans had given her. Chess isn't always competitive, she said. But you play to win. Beth wanted to say something about how beautiful chess was sometimes. But she looked at Miss Balky's sharp, inquiring face and couldn't find the words for it. Do you have a boyfriend? No, I'm 14. The photographer began snapping pictures. Miss Balky had lighted a cigarette. She leaned forward now and tapped the ashes into one of Mrs. Wheatley's ashtrays. Are you interested in boys? She asked. Beth was feeling more and more uneasy. She wanted to talk about learning chess and about the tournament she had won and about people like Morphy and Capablanca. She did not like this woman and did not like her questions. I'm interested in chess, mostly. Miss Balky smiled brightly. Tell me about it, she said. Tell me how you learned to play and how old you were. Beth told her, and Miss Balky took notes. But Beth felt that she wasn't really interested in any of it. She found as she went on talking that she really had very little to say. The next week at school, during algebra class, Beth saw the boy in front of her pass a copy of Life to the girl next to him, and they both turned and looked back at her as though they had never seen her before. After class, the boy, who had never spoken to her before, stopped her and asked if she would autograph the magazine. Beth was stunned. She took it from him, and there it was, filling a full page. There was a picture of her looking serious at her chessboard, and there was another picture of the main building at Methuen. Across the top of the page, a headline read, A Girl Mozart Startles the World of Chess. She signed her name with the boy's ballpoint pen, setting the magazine on an empty desk. When she got home, Mrs. Wheatley had the magazine in her lap. She began reading aloud. With some people, chess is a pastime. With others, it is a compulsion, even an addiction. And every now and then, a person comes along for whom it is a birthright. Now and then a small boy appears and dazzles us with his precocity at what may be the world's most difficult game. But what if that boy were a girl? A young, unsmiling girl with brown eyes, brown hair, and a dark blue dress. It has never happened before, but it happened recently. In Lexington, Kentucky, and in Cincinnati, in Charleston, Atlanta, Miami, and lately in New York City. Into the male-dominated world of the nation's top chess tournaments strolls a 14-year-old with bright, intense eyes from 8th grade at Fairfield Junior High in Lexington, Kentucky. She is quiet and well-mannered, and she is out for blood. It's marvelous, Mrs. Wheatley said. Shall I read on? It talks about the orphanage. Beth had bought her own copy. And it gives one of my games, but it's mostly about my being a girl. Well, you are one. It shouldn't be that important, Beth said. They didn't print half the things I told them. They didn't tell about Mr. Scheibel. They didn't say anything about how I play the Sicilian. But Beth, Mrs. Wheatley said, it makes you a celebrity. Beth looked at her thoughtfully. For being a girl, mostly, she said. The next day, Margaret stopped her in the hall. Margaret was wearing a camel's hair coat, and her blonde hair fell just to her shoulders. She was even more beautiful than she had been a year before, when Beth had taken the $10 from her purse.
"The other apple pies asked me to invite you," Margaret said respectfully. "We're having a pledge party Friday night at my house."
The apple pies. It was very strange. When Beth accepted and asked for the address, she realized it was the first time she had ever actually spoken to Margaret. She spent over an hour that afternoon trying on dresses at Purcell's before picking a navy blue with a simple white collar from the store's most expensive line. When she showed it to Mrs. Wheatley that evening and told her she was going to the Apple Pie Club, Mrs. Wheatley was clearly pleased.
"You look just like a debutante," she said, when Beth tried on the dress for her.
The white woodwork of Margaret's living room glistened beautifully, and the pictures on the walls were oil paintings, mostly of horses. Even though it was a mild evening in March, a big fire burned under the white mantle. 14 girls were sitting on the white sofas and colored wingback chairs when Beth arrived in her new dress. Most of the others were wearing sweaters and skirts.
"It was really something," one of them said, "to find a face from Fairfield Junior High in life. I nearly flipped."
But when Beth started to talk about the tournaments, the girls interrupted her to ask about the boys at them. Were they good looking? Did she date any of them? When Beth said, "There's not much time for that," the girls changed the subject. For an hour or more, they talked about boys and dating and clothes, veering erratically from cool sophistication to giggles, while Beth sat uneasily at one end of the sofa, holding a crystal glass of Coca-Cola, unable to think of anything to say. Then, at 9 o'clock, Margaret turned on the huge television set by the fireplace, and they were all quiet, except for an occasional giggle, while the movie of the week came on. Beth sat through it, not participating in the gossip and laughter during the commercials, until it ended at 11. She was astounded at the dullness of the evening. This was the elite apple pie club that had seemed so important when she first went to school in Lexington. And this was what they did at their sophisticated parties. They watched a Charles Bronson movie. The only break in the dullness was when a girl named Felicia said,
"I wonder if he's as well hung as he looks."
Beth laughed at that, but it was the only thing she laughed at. When she left after 11, no one urged her to stay, and no one said anything about her joining. She was relieved to get into the taxi and go home, and when she got there, she spent an hour in her room with the middle game in chess, translated from the Russian of D. Lichenko. The school knew about her well enough by the next tournament, and this time she hadn't claimed illness as an excuse. Mrs. Wheatley talked to the principal, and Beth was excused from her classes. Nothing was said about the illnesses she had lied about. They wrote her up in the school paper, and people pointed her out in the hallways. The tournament was in Kansas City, and after she won it, the director took her and Mrs. Wheatley to a steakhouse for dinner and told her they were honored to have her participate. He was a serious young man, and he treated both of them politely.
"I'd like to play in the U.S. Open," Beth said over dessert and coffee.
"Sure," he said. "You might win it."
"Would that lead to playing abroad?" Mrs. Wheatley asked. "In Europe, I mean?"
"No reason why not," the young man said.
His name was Noble. He wore thick glasses and kept drinking ice water.
"They have to know about you before they invite you."
"Would winning the Open make them know about me?"
"Sure. Benny Watts plays in Europe all the time, now that he's got his international title."
"How's the prize money?" Mrs. Wheatley asked, lighting a cigarette.
"Pretty good, I think."
"What about Russia?"
Beth said.
Noble stared at her a minute, as though she had suggested something illicit.
Russia's murder, he said finally. They eat Americans for breakfast over there.
Now, really, Mrs. Wheatley said. They really do, Noble said. I don't think there's been an American with a prayer against the Russians for 20 years. It's like ballet. They pay people to play chess.
Beth thought of those pictures in Chess Review, of the men with grim faces bending over chessboards, Borgov and Tal, Liev and Shapkin, scowling, wearing dark suits. Chess in Russia was a different thing than chess in America. Finally, she asked, "How do I get in the U.S. Open?"
"Just send in an entry fee," Noble said. "It's like any other tournament, except the competition's stiffer."
She sent in her entry fee, but she did not play in the U.S. Open that year. Mrs. Wheatley developed a virus that kept her in bed for 2 weeks, and Beth, who had just passed her 15th birthday, was unwilling to go alone. She did her best to hide it, but she was furious at Alma Wheatley for being sick, and at herself for being afraid to make the trip to Los Angeles. The Open was not as important as the U.S. Championship, but it was time she started playing in something other than events chosen solely on the basis of the prize money. There was a tight little world of tournaments, like the United States Championship and the Meriwether Invitational, that she knew of through overheard conversations and from articles in Chess Review. It was time she got into it, and then into international chess. Sometimes she would visualize herself as what she wanted to become, a truly professional woman and the finest chess player in the world, traveling confidently by herself in the first-class cabins of airplanes, tall, perfectly dressed, good-looking and poised, a kind of white Jolene. She often told herself that she would send Jolene a card or a letter, but she never did. Instead, she would study herself in the bathroom mirror, looking for signs of that poised and beautiful woman she wanted to become. At 16, she had grown taller and better looking, had learned to have her hair cut in a way that showed her eyes to some advantage. But she still looked like a schoolgirl. She played tournaments about every 6 weeks now, in states like Illinois and Tennessee, and sometimes in New York. They still chose ones that would pay enough to show a profit after the expenses for the two of them. Her bank account grew, and that was a considerable pleasure. But somehow, her career seemed to be on a plateau, and she was too old to be called a prodigy anymore.
6. Although the U.S. Open was being held in Las Vegas, the other people at the Mariposa Hotel seemed oblivious to it. In the main room, the players at the craps tables, at roulette, and at the blackjack tables, wore brightly colored double knits and shirts. They went about their business in silence. On the other side of the casino was the hotel coffee shop. The day before the tournament, Beth walked down an aisle between crapshooters, where the main sound was the tapping of clay chips and of dice on felt. In the coffee shop, she slid onto a stool at the counter, turned around to look at the mostly empty booths, and saw a handsome young man sitting hunched over a cup of coffee, alone. It was Towns, from Lexington. She stood up and went over to the booth.
"Hello," she said.
He looked up and blinked, not recognizing her at first. Then he said,
"Harmon, for Christ's sake!
Can I sit down?"
"Sure," he said. "I should have known you. You were on the list."
"The list?"
"The tournament list. I'm not playing. Chess Review sent me to write it up."
He looked at her.
"I could write you up, for the Herald Leader."
"Lexington?"
"You got it. You've grown a lot, Harmon. I saw the piece in Life."
He looked at her closely.
"You've even gotten good looking."
She felt flustered and did not know what to say. Everything about Las Vegas was strange.
On the table in each booth was a lamp with a glass base filled with purple liquid that bubbled and swirled below its bright pink shade. The waitress who handed her a menu was dressed in a black miniskirt and fishnet hose, but she had the face of a geometry teacher. Towns was handsome, smiling, dressed in a dark sweater with a striped shirt open at the throat. She chose the Mariposa special, hotcakes, scrambled eggs, and chili peppers with the bottomless cup of coffee.
"I could do half a page on you for the Sunday paper,"
Towns was saying. The hotcakes and eggs came, and Beth ate them and drank two cups of coffee.
"I've got a camera in my room," Towns said.
He hesitated.
"I've got chessboards, too. Do you want to play?"
She shrugged. "Okay, let's go up."
"Terrific."
His smile was dazzling. The drapes were open, with a view of a parking lot. The bed was huge and unmade. It seemed to fill the room. There were three chessboards set up, one on a table by the window, one on the bureau, and the third in the bathroom next to the basin. He posed her by the window and shot a roll of film, while she sat at the board and moved the pieces. It was difficult not to look at him as he walked around. When he came close to her and held a little light meter near her face, she found herself catching her breath at the sensation of warmth from his body. Her heart was beating fast, and when she reached out to move a rook, she saw that her fingers were trembling. He clicked off the last shot and began rewinding the film.
"One of those should do it," he said.
He set the camera on the nightstand by the bed.
"Let's play chess."
She looked at him. "I don't know what your first name is."
"Everyone calls me Towns," he said. "Maybe that's why I call you Harmon instead of Elizabeth."
She began setting up the pieces on the board. "It's Beth."
"I'd rather call you Harmon."
"Let's play Skittles," she said. "You can play white." Skittles was speed chess, and there wasn't time for much complexity. He got his chess clock from the bureau and set it to give them each 5 minutes.
"I should give you 3, he said.
"Go ahead," Beth said, not looking at him. She wished he would just come over and touch her, on the arm maybe, or put his hand on her cheek. He seemed terribly sophisticated, and his smile was easy. He couldn't be thinking about her the way she was thinking about him. But Jolene had said, "They all think about it, honey. That's just what they think about." And they were alone in his room, with the king-sized bed, in Las Vegas. When he set the clock at the side of the board, she saw they both had the same amount of time. She did not want to play this game with him. She wanted to make love with him. She punched the button on her side, and his clock started ticking. He moved pawn to king 4 and pushed his button. She held her breath for a moment and began to play chess. When Beth came back to their room, Mrs. Wheatley was sitting in bed, smoking a cigarette and looking mournful.
"Where have you been, honey?" she said.
Her voice was quiet and had some of the strain it had when she spoke of Mr. Wheatley. "Playing chess," Beth said. "Practicing." There was a copy of Chess Review on the television set. Beth got it and opened it to the masthead page. His name wasn't among the editors, but down below, under correspondence, were three names. The third was D.L. Towns. She still didn't know his first name. After a moment, Mrs. Wheatley said, "Would you hand me a can of beer?" "On the dresser." Beth stood up. 5 cans of Pabst were on one of the brown trays room service used, and a half-eaten bag of potato chips.
"Why don't you have one yourself?" Mrs. Wheatley said.
Beth picked up 2 cans. They felt metallic and cold. okay?
She handed them to Mrs. Wheatley and got herself a clean glass from the bathroom. When Beth gave her the glass, Mrs. Wheatley said,
I guess you've never had a beer before?
I'm 16.
Well,
Mrs. Wheatley frowned. She lifted the tab with a little pop and poured expertly into Beth's glass until the white collar stood above the rim.
Here, she said, as though offering medicine.
Beth sipped the beer. She had never had it before, but it tasted much as she had expected, as though she had always known what beer would taste like. She tried not to make a face and finished almost half the glass. Mrs. Wheatley reached out from the bed and poured the rest of it in. Beth drank another mouthful. It stung her throat, slightly, but then she felt a sensation of warmth in her stomach. Her face was flushed, as though she were blushing. She finished off the glassful.
Goodness, Mrs. Wheatley said. You shouldn't drink so fast.
I'd like another, Beth said.
She was thinking of Towns, how he had looked after they finished playing and she stood up to leave. He had smiled and taken her hand. Just holding his hand for that short time made her cheeks feel the way the beer had. She had won 7 fast games from him. She held her glass tightly and for a moment wanted to throw it on the floor as hard as she could and watch it shatter. Instead, she walked over, picked up another can of beer, put her finger in the ring, and opened it.
You really shouldn't, Mrs. Wheatley said.
Beth filled her glass.
Well, Mrs. Wheatley said, resigned. If you're going to do that, let me have one too. I just don't want you to be sick.
Beth banged her shoulder against the doorframe going into the bathroom and barely got to the toilet in time. It stung her nose horribly as she threw up. After she finished, she stood by the toilet for a while and began to cry. Yet even while she was crying, she knew that she had made a discovery with the 3 cans of beer. A discovery as important as the one she had made when she was 8 years old and saved up her green pills and then took them all at one time. With the pills, there was a long wait before the swooning came into her stomach and loosened the tightness. The beer gave her the same feeling with almost no wait.
No more beer, honey, Mrs. Wheatley said when Beth came back into the bedroom. Not until you're 18.
The ballroom was set up for 70 chess players, and Beth's first game was at board 9, against a small man from Oklahoma. She beat him, as if in a dream, in 24 moves. That afternoon, at board 4, she crushed the defenses of a serious young man from New York, playing the king's gambit and sacrificing the bishop the way Paul Morphy had done. Benny Watts was in his 20s, but he looked nearly as young as Beth. He was not much taller, either. Beth saw him from time to time during the tournament. He started at board 1 and stayed there. People said he was the best American player since Morphy. Beth stood near him once at the Coke machine, but they did not speak. He was talking to another male player and smiling a lot. They were amiably debating the virtues of the semi-Slav defense. Beth had made a study of the semi-Slav a few days before, and she had a good deal to say about it. But she remained silent, got her Coke, and walked away. Listening to the two of them, she had felt something unpleasant and familiar, the sense that chess was a thing between men, and she was an outsider. She hated the feeling. Watts was wearing a white shirt, open at the collar, with the sleeves rolled up. His face was both cheerful and sly. With his flat, straw-colored hair, he looked as American as Huckleberry Finn. Yet there was something untrustworthy about his eyes. He, too, had been a child prodigy, and that, besides the fact that he was a champion, made Beth uneasy.
She remembered a Watts game book with a draw against Borstmann and a caption reading Copenhagen, 1948. That meant Benny had been 8 years old, the age Beth was when she was playing Mr. Scheibel in the basement. In the middle of that book was a photograph of him at 13, standing solemnly at a long table, facing a group of uniformed midshipmen seated at chessboards. He had played against the 23-man team at Annapolis without losing a game. When she came back with her empty Coke bottle, he was still standing by the machine. He looked at her. "Hey," he said pleasantly, "you're Beth Harmon." She put the bottle in the case. "Yes." "I saw the piece in Life," he said. "The game they printed was a pretty one." It was the game she'd won against Beltic. "Thanks," she said. "I'm Benny Watts."
"I know."
"You shouldn't have castled, though," he said, smiling. She stared at him. "I needed to get the rook out." "You could have lost your king pawn." She wasn't sure what he was talking about. She remembered the game well, and had gone over it in her head a few times, but found nothing wrong with it. Was it possible he had memorized the moves from Life and found a weakness? Or was he just showing off? Standing there, she pictured the position after the castle. The king pawn looked all right to her.
"I don't think so."
"He plays bishop to b5, and you've got to break the pin."
"Wait a minute," she said.
"I can't," Benny said. "I've got to play an adjournment. Set it up and think it out. Your problem is his queen knight." Suddenly she was angry.
"I don't have to set it up to think it out."
"Goodness," he said, and laughed. When he was gone, she stood by the Coke machine for several minutes going over the game. And then she saw it. There was an empty tournament board on a table near her. She set up the position before castling against Beltic, just to be certain, but she felt a knot in her stomach doing it. Beltic could have made the pin, and then his queen knight became a threat. She had to break the pin and then protect against a fork with that damned knight. And after that, he had a rook threat, and bingo. There went her pawn. It could have been crucial. But what was worse, she hadn't seen it. And Benny Watts, just reading Life magazine, reading about a player he knew nothing about, had picked it up. She was standing at the board. She bit her lip, reached down, and toppled the king. She had been so proud of finding an error in a Morphy game when she was in seventh grade. Now she'd had something like that done to her. And she did not like it. Not at all. She was sitting behind the white pieces at board one when Watts came in. When he shook her hand, he said in a low voice, "Knight to knight five, right?"
"Yes," she said between her teeth.
A flash bulb popped. Beth pushed her queen's pawn to queen four. She played the queen's gambit against him, and by mid-game, felt with dismay that it had been a mistake. The queen's gambit could lead to complicated positions, and this one was Byzantine. There were half a dozen threats on each side, and the thing that made her nervous, that made her reach out for a piece several times and then stop her hand before touching it and draw back, was that she didn't trust herself. She did not trust herself to see everything Benny Watts could see. He played with a calm, pleasant precision, picking up his pieces lightly and setting them down noiselessly, sometimes smiling to himself as he did so. Every move he made looked solid as a rock. Beth's great strength was in fast attack, and she could find no way to attack. By the 16th move, she was furious with herself for playing the gambit in the first place. There must have been 40 people clustered around the especially large wooden table. There was a brown velvet curtain behind them, with the names Harmon and Watts pinned to it. The horrible feeling, at the bottom of the anger and fear, was that she was the weaker player, that Benny Watts knew more about chess than she did and could play it better. It was a new feeling for her, and it seemed to bind and restrict her, as she had not been bound and restricted since the last time she sat in Mrs. Deerdorf's office. For a moment, she looked over the crowd around the table, trying to find Mrs. Wheatley. But she was not there. Beth turned back to the board and looked briefly at Benny. He smiled at her serenely, as though he were offering her a drink rather than a head-splitting chess position. Beth set her elbows on the table, leaned her cheeks against her clenched fists, and began to concentrate. After a moment, a simple thought came to her. I'm not playing Benny Watts. I'm playing chess. She looked at him again. His eyes were studying the board now. He can't move until I do. He can only move one piece at a time. She looked back to the board and began to consider the effects of trading, to picture where the pawns would be if the pieces that clogged the center were exchanged. If she took his king knight with her bishop and he retook with the queen pawn, no good. She could advance the knight and force a trade. That was better. She blinked and began to relax, forming and reforming the relationships of pawns in her mind, searching for a way of forcing an advantage. There was nothing in front of her now but the 64 squares and the shifting architecture of pawns, a jagged skyline of imaginary pawns, black and white, that flowed and shifted as she tried variation after variation, branch after branch of the game tree that grew from each set of moves. One branch began to look better than the others. She followed it for several half moves to the possibilities that grew from it, holding in her mind the whole set of imaginary positions until she found one that had what she wanted to find. She sighed and sat upright. When she pulled her face away from her fists, her cheeks were sore and her shoulders stiff. She looked at her clock. 40 minutes had passed. Watts was yawning. She reached out and made the move, advancing a knight in a way that would force the first trade. It looked innocuous enough. Then she punched the clock. Watts studied the board for half a minute and started the trade. For a moment, she felt panic in her stomach. Could he see what she was planning that quickly? She tried to shake off the idea and took the offered piece. He took another, just as she had planned. She took. Watts reached out to take again, but hesitated. Do it, she commanded silently. But he pulled his hand back. If he saw through what she was planning, there was still time to get out of it. She bit her lip. He was studying the board intently. He would see it. The ticking of the clock seemed very loud. Beth's heart was beating so strongly that for a moment, she feared Watts would hear it and know she was panicked and... But he didn't. He took the trade just as she had planned it. She looked at his face almost in disbelief. It was too late for him now. He pressed the button that stopped his clock and started hers. She pushed the pawn up to Rook 5. Immediately, he stiffened in his chair, almost imperceptibly, but Beth saw it. He began studying the position intently. But he must have seen he was going to be stuck with doubled pawns. After 2 or 3 minutes, he shrugged and made the necessary move. And Beth did her continuation. And then, on the next move, the pawn was doubled, and the nervousness and anger had left her. She was out to win now. She would hammer at his weakness. She loved it. She loved attack. Benny looked at her impassively for a moment. Then he reached out his hand, picked up his queen, and did something astonishing. He quietly captured her center pawn, her protected pawn, the pawn that had been holding the queen to her corner for most of the game. He was sacrificing his queen. She could not believe it. And then she saw what it meant, and her stomach twisted sharply. How had she missed it? With the pawn gone, she was open to a rook-bishop mate because of the bishop on the open diagonal. She could protect by retreating her knight and moving one of her rooks over, but the protection wouldn't last because, she saw now with horror, his innocent-looking knight would block her king's escape. It was terrible. It was the kind of thing she did to other people. It was the kind of thing Paul Morphy had done. And she had been thinking about doubled pawns. She didn't have to take the queen. What would happen if she didn't? She would lose the pawn he had just taken. His queen would sit there in the center of the board. Worse, it could come over to her king-rook file and press down on her castled king. The more she looked, the worse it became, and it had caught her completely off guard. She put her elbows on the table and stared at the position. She needed a counter-threat, a move that would stop him in his tracks. There wasn't any. She spent a half hour studying the board and found only that Benny's move was even sounder than she had thought. Maybe she could trade her way out of it if he attacked too quickly. She found a rook move and made it. If he would just bring the queen over now, there would be a chance to trade. He didn't. He developed his other bishop. She brought the rook up to the second rank. Then he swung the queen over, threatening mate in three. She had to respond by retreating her knight into the corner. He kept attacking. And with impotent dismay, she saw a lost game gradually become manifest. When he took her king-bishop pawn with his bishop, sacrificing it, it was over. And she knew it was over. There was nothing to do. She wanted to scream, but instead set her king on its side and got up from the table. Her legs and back were stiff and painful. Her stomach was knotted. All she had really needed was a draw, and she hadn't been able to get even that. Benny had drawn twice already in the tournament. She had gone into the game with a perfect score, and a draw would have given her the title. But she had gone for a win. "Tough game," Benny was saying. He was holding out his hand. She forced herself to take it. People were applauding, not applauding her, but Benny Watts. By evening, she could still feel it, but it had lessened. Mrs. Wheatley tried to console her. The prize money would be split. She and Benny would be co-champions, each with a small trophy. "It happens all the time," Mrs. Wheatley said. "I have made inquiries, and the Open Championship is often shared." "I didn't see what he was doing," Beth said, picturing the move where his queen took her pawn. "It was like putting your tongue against an aching tooth." "You can't finesse everything, dear," Mrs. Wheatley said. "Nobody can." Beth looked at her. "You don't know anything about chess," she said. "I know what it feels like to lose." "I bet you do," Beth said, as viciously as she could. "I just bet you do." Mrs. Wheatley peered at her meditatively for a moment. "And now you do, too," she said softly. Sometimes on the street that winter in Lexington, people would look back over their shoulders at her. She was on the morning show on WLEX. The interviewer, a woman with heavily lacquered hair and harlequin glasses, asked Beth if she played bridge. Beth said no. Did she like being the U.S. Open champion at chess? Beth said she was co-champion. Beth sat in a director's chair with bright lights shining on her face. She was willing to talk about chess, but the woman's manner, her false appearance of interest, made it difficult. Finally, she was asked how she felt about the idea that chess was a waste of time, and she looked at the woman in the other chair and said, "No more than basketball." But before she could go on about that, the show was over. She had been on for 6 minutes. The one-page article Towns had written about her appeared in the Sunday supplement of the Herald Leader, with one of the pictures he had taken at the window of his room in Las Vegas. She liked herself in the picture, with her right hand on the white queen and her face looking clear, serious, and intelligent. Mrs. Wheatley bought 5 copies of the paper for her scrapbook. Beth was in high school now, and there was a chess club, but she did not belong. The boys in it were nonplussed to have a master walking the hallways, and they would stare at her in a kind of embarrassed awe when she passed. Once, a boy from 12th grade stopped her to ask nervously if she would give a simultaneous in chess club sometime. She would play about 30 students at once. She remembered that other high school, near Methuen, and the way she was stared at afterward. "I'm sorry," she said. "I don't have time." The boy was unattractive and creepy-looking. It made her feel unattractive and creepy just to be talking with him. She spent about an hour a night on her homework and made A's. But homework meant nothing to her. It was the 5 or 6 hours of studying chess that was at the center of her life. She was enrolled as a special student at the university for a class in Russian that met 1 night a week. It was the only schoolwork that she paid serious attention to. 7. Beth puffed, inhaled, and held the smoke in. There was nothing to it. She handed the joint to the young man on her right, and he said, "Thank you." He had been talking about Donald Duck with Eileen. They were in Eileen and Barbara's apartment, a block off Main Street. It was Eileen who had invited Beth to the party after the night class. "It's gotta be Mel Blanc," Eileen was saying now. "They're all Mel Blanc." Beth was still holding the smoke in, hoping that it would loosen her up. She had been sitting on the floor with these college students for 30 minutes and had said nothing. "Blank does Sylvester, but he doesn't do Donald Duck," the young man said with finality. He turned around to face Beth. "I'm Tim," he said. "You're the chess player." Beth let the smoke out.
"That's right."
"You're the U.S. women's champion."
"I'm the U.S. Open co-champion," Beth said.
"Sorry, it must be a trip." He was red-haired and thin.
She had seen him sitting in the middle of the classroom and could remember his soft voice when they recited Russian phrases in unison.
"Do you play?"
Beth did not like the strain in her voice. She felt out of place. She should either go home or call Mrs. Wheatley. He shook his head.
"Too cerebral. You want a beer?"
She hadn't had a beer since Las Vegas, a year before.
"Okay," she said.
She started to get up from the floor.
"I'll get it."
He pushed himself up from where they were sitting on the carpet. He came back with 2 cans and handed her one. She took a long drink. During the first hour, the music had been so loud that conversation was impossible. But when the last record ended, no one replaced it. The disc on the hi-fi against the far wall was still turning, and she could see the little red lights on the amplifier. She hoped no one would notice and play another record. Tim eased himself back down next to her with a sigh.
"I used to play Monopoly a lot."
"I've never played that."
"It makes you a slave of capitalism. I still dream about big bucks."
Beth laughed. The joint had come back her way, and she held it between her fingertips and got what she could from it before passing it to Tim.
Why are you taking Russian? She said, if you're a slave of capitalism.
She took another swallow of beer.
You've got nice boobs, he said, and took a drag. We need another joint, he announced to the group at large.
He turned back to Beth.
I wanted to read Dostoevsky in the original.
She finished her beer. Somebody produced another joint and began sending it around. There were a dozen people in the room. They'd had their first exam in the evening class, and Beth had been invited to the party afterward. With the beer and marijuana and talking to Tim, who seemed very easy to talk to, she felt better. When the joint came up again, she took a long drag on it, and then another. Someone put on a record. The music sounded much better, and the loudness didn't bother her now. Suddenly, she stood up. I ought to call home, she said.
In the bedroom, through the kitchen.
In the kitchen, she opened another beer. She took a long swallow, pushed open the bedroom door, and felt for a light switch. She could not find it. A box of wooden matches sat on the stove by the frying pan, and she took it into the bedroom. She still could not find a switch, but on the dresser was a collection of candles in different shapes. She lit one and shook out the match. She stared for a moment at the candle. It was a lavender upright wax penis with a pair of glossy testicles at its base. The wick came from the glands, and most of the glands had already melted away. Something in her was shocked. The telephone was on a table by the unmade bed. She carried the candle with her, sat on the edge of the bed, and dialed. Mrs. Wheatley was a bit confused at first. She was dazed from either TV or beer.
You go on to bed, Beth said. I've got a key.
Did you say you were partying with college students? Mrs. Wheatley said. From the university?
Yes.
Well, be careful what you smoke, honey.
There was a marvelous feeling across Beth's shoulders and on the back of her neck. For a moment she wanted to rush home and embrace Mrs. Wheatley and hold her tight. But all she said was,
Okay.
See you in the morning, Mrs. Wheatley said.
Beth sat on the edge of the bed, listening to the music from the living room, and finished her beer. She hardly ever listened to music, and had never been to a school dance. If you didn't count the apple pies, this was the first party she had ever been to. In the living room, the song ended. A moment later, Tim sat on the bed beside her. It seemed perfectly natural, like the response to a request she had made.
Have another beer, he said.
She took it and drank. Her movements felt slow and certain.
Jesus, Tim whispered in mock alarm. What's that purple thing burning there?
You tell me, Beth said.
She panicked for a moment as he pushed himself into her. It seemed frighteningly big, and she felt helpless, as if she were in a dentist chair. But that didn't last. He was careful, and it didn't hurt badly. She put her arms around his back, feeling the roughness of his bulky sweater. He began moving. He began to squeeze her breasts under her blouse.
Don't do that, she said,
and he said,
Whatever you say.
And kept moving in and out. She could barely feel his penis now, but it was all right. She was 17, and it was about time. He was wearing a condom. The best part had been watching him put it on, joking about it. What they were doing was really all right, and nothing like books or movies. Fucking. Well now, if only he were Towns. Afterward, she fell asleep on the bed. Not in a lover's embrace, not even touching the man she had just made love with,
but sprawled out on the bed with her clothes on. She saw Tim blow out the candle and heard the door close quietly after him. When she awoke, she saw by the electric alarm clock that it was nearly 10 in the morning. Sunlight came around the edges of the bedroom window blinds. The air smelled stale. Her legs were prickly from her wool skirt, and the neck of her sweater had been pressed against her throat, which felt sweaty. She was ferociously hungry. She sat on the edge of the bed a minute, blinking. She got up and pushed open the kitchen door. Empty bottles and beer cans were everywhere. The air was foul with dead smoke. A note was fastened to the refrigerator door with a magnet in the shape of Mickey Mouse's head. It read, "Everybody went to Cincinnati to see a movie. Stay as long as you like." The bathroom was off the living room. When she had finished showering and had dried herself, she wrapped a towel around her hair, went back to the kitchen and opened the refrigerator. There were eggs in a carton, 2 cans of Budweiser, and some pickles. On the door shelf was a baggie. She picked it up. Inside was a single, tightly rolled joint. She took it out, put it in her mouth, and lit it with a wooden match. She inhaled deeply. Then she took out 4 eggs and put them on to boil. She had never felt so hungry in her life. She cleaned up the apartment in an organized way, as if she were playing chess, getting 4 large grocery bags to put all the bottles and butts in, and stacking these on the back porch. She found a half-full bottle of Ripple and 4 unopened beer cans in the debris. She opened a beer and began vacuuming the living room carpet. Hanging over a chair in the bedroom was a pair of jeans. When she had finished cleaning, she changed into them. They fit her perfectly. She found a white t-shirt in a drawer and put it on. Then she drank the rest of her beer and opened another. Someone had left a lipstick on the back of the toilet. She went to the bathroom and studied herself in the mirror, reddened her lips carefully. She had never worn lipstick before. She was beginning to feel very good. Mrs. Wheatley's voice sounded faint and anxious. "You might have called." "I'm sorry," Beth said. "I didn't want to wake you up."
"I wouldn't have minded.
Anyway, I'm all right, and I'm going to Cincinnati to see a movie. I won't be home tonight, either."
There was a silence at the other end of the line.
"I'll be back after school Monday."
Finally, Mrs. Wheatley spoke. "Are you with a boy?"
"I was last night."
"Oh." Mrs. Wheatley's voice sounded distant. "Beth." Beth laughed.
"Come on," she said. "I'm all right."
"Well."
She still sounded grave. Then her voice became lighter.
"I suppose it's all right. It's just that..."
Beth smiled. "I won't get pregnant," she said. At noon, she put the rest of the eggs in a pot to boil and turned on the hi-fi. She had never really listened to music before, but she listened now. She danced a few steps in the middle of the living room, waiting for the eggs. She would not let herself get sick. She would eat frequently and drink 1 beer, or 1 glass of wine, every hour. She had made love the night before, and now it was time to learn about being drunk. She was alone, and she liked it. It was the way she had learned everything important in her life. At 4 in the afternoon, she walked into Larry's package store a block from the apartment and bought a 1/5 of Ripple. When the man was putting it in the bag, she said, "Do you have a wine like Ripple that's not so sweet?"
"These soda pop wines are all the same," the man said.
"What about Burgundy?"
Sometimes Mrs. Wheatley ordered Burgundy with her dinner when they ate out.
"I've got Gallo, Italian Swiss Colony, Parmesan."
"Parmesan," Beth said.
2 bottles.
That night, at 11, she was able to get undressed by being careful. She had found a pair of pajamas earlier, and she managed to get them on and to pile her clothes on a chair before getting into bed and passing out. No one had come back by morning. She made scrambled eggs and ate them with 2 pieces of toast before having her first glass of wine. It was another sunny day. In the living room, she found Vivaldi's The Four Seasons. She put it on. Then she began drinking in earnest. On Monday morning, Beth took a taxi to Henry Clay High School and arrived 10 minutes before her first class. She had left the apartment empty and clean. The owners had not yet returned from Cincinnati. Most of the wrinkles had hung out of her sweater and skirt, but she had washed her Argyle socks. She had drunk the 2nd bottle of Burgundy Sunday night and slept soundly for 10 hours. Now, in the taxi, there was a dim ache at the back of her head, and her hands trembled slightly. But outside the window, the May morning was exquisite, and the green of the young leaves on trees was delicate and fresh. By the time she paid and got out, she felt light and springy, ready to go ahead and finish high school and devote her energy to chess. She had $3,000 in her savings account, she was no longer a virgin, and she knew how to drink. There was an embarrassed silence when she came home after school. Mrs. Wheatley, wearing a blue house dress, was mopping the kitchen floor. Beth settled herself on the sofa and picked up Reuben Fine's book on the endgame. It was a book she hated. She had seen a can of Pabst on the side of the sink, but she did not want any. It would be better not to drink anything for a long while. She had had enough. When Mrs. Wheatley finished, she set the mop against the refrigerator and came into the living room. "I see you're back," she began. Her voice was carefully neutral. Beth looked at her. "I had a good time," she said. Mrs. Wheatley seemed uncertain what attitude to take. Finally, she allowed herself a small smile. It was surprisingly shy, like a girl's smile. "Well," she said, "chess isn't the only thing in life." Beth graduated from high school in June, and Mrs. Wheatley gave her a Bulova watch. The back of the case read, "With love, from Mother." She liked that, but what she liked better was the rating that came in the mail. 2243. At the school party, several other graduates offered Beth surreptitious drinks, but she refused. She had fruit punch and went home early. She needed to study. She would be playing her first international tournament in Mexico City in 2 weeks, and after that came the United States Championship. She had been invited to the Remy Vallon in Paris at the end of the summer. Things were beginning to happen. 8. An hour after the plane crossed the border, Beth was absorbed in pawn structure analysis and Mrs. Wheatley was drinking her 3rd bottle of Cerveza Corona.
"Beth," Mrs. Wheatley said, "I have a confession to make."
Beth put the book down reluctantly. Mrs. Wheatley seemed nervous.
"Do you know what a pen pal is, dear?"
"Someone you trade letters with?"
"Exactly. When I was in high school, our Spanish class was given a list of boys in Mexico who were studying English. I picked one and sent him a letter about myself."
Mrs. Wheatley gave a little laugh.
"His name was Manuel. We corresponded for a long time, even while I was married to Alston. We exchanged photographs."
Mrs. Wheatley opened her purse, rummaged through it, and produced a bent snapshot which she handed to Beth. It was a picture of a thin-faced man.